Session number 8634.
General Yangaril II, what happened next?
Well, perhaps I should first explain that on my half, that's the right-hand half of this landing, our objective, 2-6 Squadron's objective, was to create two gaps. And I had two troops to do this, each with some flails under command. One troop commanded by Captain Jimmy Hewitt, and two troop commanded by Captain Jimmy Hendry. Now, as the flap of our landing craft went down, and I could see the beach more clearly, I realized straight away that something was wrong, because on Jimmy Hewitt's gap, which was the westernmost gap, there appeared to be nobody. And on Jimmy Hendry's gap, there were a whole mass of tanks. Anyway, the tanks in front of me, I think there were six tanks on board, two flails and four Averys. And I was the last but one to get off the landing craft. As we landed, I saw a burst of something in the water, and there's nothing you can do about that. I realized we're being fired at by something, a mortar or something or other. Anyway, the waterproofing was fine, and we got quite close, still in the water, we got quite close to dry land, when suddenly I found myself sitting on the bottom of the tank, and I didn't know what had happened at all. I saw my wireless operator looking down at me, and I said to him, "What the hell have you done?" I just couldn't realize why I was sitting on the floor of the tank when I knew I ought to be looking out of it. And he said, "Sir, we've been hit." I realized the moment he started to speak that my hearing was very bad, and what had happened had been that a shell of some sort had hit the turret of the tank just on the other side of the open turret hatch to my head, and it had burst there and knocked half the turret hatch down onto my head, but luckily I was wearing a steel helmet and there was a ridge down that, and it had knocked me out and bust an eardrum, and otherwise not done me any harm, because luckily I was shielded by the half of the turret hatch. The other thing, however, it had done had taken off the aerials from the tank, so that I couldn't use the tank as a command vehicle any longer. So we got onto the beach, and I sort of pulled myself together and got. I realized I had to get out of the tank in order to command anybody. I got out and I ran across the open beach. There were quite a number of casualties already on the beach, and there were little groups of Canadian infantry sheltering in the sand dunes. And I went up to this great conglomeration of our tanks, about 8 or 9 of them there, at the entrance, which I knew straight away to be what should be two troops projected gap. And the first thing I did was to look out the commander of one troop, Hewitt, Jimmy Hewitt, to ask him what on earth he was doing there. And I found him, and he said, "Oh, well, his landing craft had landed him there, so he thought it would be best to go on in," which was not a very good answer. So I told him to collect his men and get them over to the correct gap that he was meant to be making, which was another, I suppose, a couple of 300 yards to the west. However, by then, his front tank, which was numbered 1 Charlie, our tanks were 1 Abel Baker Charlie dog and so on in one troop, two Abel Baker Charlie dog in two troop and so on. One Charlie was already through the sand dunes, and it was teetering on the edge of what looked like a huge crater, and was indeed a huge crater. There'd been a culvert or something there. It'd been blown by the Germans, and it had formed a crater which was 66 feet across. And this was a big crater. And this tank was teetering on the edge of it. And as I just came up there, I saw it sort of nudge into the crater, into the water. And then the crew got out of it to avoid being drowned and ran for cover. Three of them were killed doing this. And of the other three, one died later, and two survivors are still alive, but they've both lost, one lost a leg and an arm, one lost a leg, and I think a lung and an eye. So they were badly wounded. But then we had this awful crater in front, with this tank three quarters of the way in it, and it couldn't have been a more greater shambles, really. The one way off the beach was blocked by this really horrible obstacle. No way of the Canadians getting any of their tanks ashore. The Canadians, incidentally, had lost they'd lost quite a number of tanks because they had these tanks called DD tanks, which were floating tanks. DD meant duplex drive, which meant they had screws, propellers, as well as tracks. Propellers drive through the water, and then they could switch off and take their tracks to go on across the land. But because they were launched rather far out, and it was such a windy day, quite a number of the tanks had got drowned. But then they had persuaded some of the landing craft to beach and let them off onto dry land. And they had mastered the beach by then. They fired straight into the embrasures of the huge pillboxes that were there and stopped the fire. They did very well. The First Hussars of Canada was the regiment they came from, and they were really a great help. And then there was this awful mess of ours, and of course the Germans were still free to fire at us behind the sand dunes. There are fairly high sand dunes at that landing place. So anyway, then we had to make a plan, and we decided that the only thing to do was to nudge this tank right into the crater, drop one of our assault bridges from the, so to speak, home bank of the crater onto the turret of the tank, and then try and put a couple of fascines beyond that in order to make some form of crossing. And Jimi Hendrix's troop went ahead and did this. And having dropped two fascines across, it looked as though it was possible to get a tank over, so I told one of the Averys to get over there, which it succeeded in doing. All the time we were improving the crossing, because there was quite a lot of rubble there. I think there may have been a house there which had been destroyed or something. Oh, and also quite soon, quite early on, a farmer with a cart was seen, and a horse. And someone went down and asked him, or didn't ask him, told him that we wanted his horse and cart, which he was delighted to let us have. And we used that to go and use the cart to be filled up with rubble from houses that had been knocked down in the bombardment, and to continue throughout the morning improving this gap.
So the cart was used to transport the rubble?
Yes. You see, there was a road parallel to the beach, about, I suppose, 300 or 400 yards from the beach, and this was our objective. If we could get to that, this was the coast road, then, of course, the Canadians could fan out and, carry out normal military operations against the enemy inland from that. And there were houses on that coast road which had been knocked down. Anyway, we got this Avery over, that our flails were stuck in the... There was a big minefield there, and our flails were in the middle of that, having lost tracks on what must have been booby-trap mines. I think the Germans were expecting flails by then. They'd been used in the Western Desert, and they knew that flails would be landed. However, the flails provided firepower. Although the tracks were knocked out, the flails, the tank gun weren't, hadn't, guns hadn't been knocked out. So they operated as sort of pillboxes, really, for us on the far side, and they fired at anything they could see that was firing at us, and they achieved a mastery over the what really were fairly light forces that the Germans had behind the sand dunes. I don't know what time of the morning. We landed about 7:30. I suppose it must have been probably 10:30 or something, by which time there was a terrific build-up of stuff on the beach. We'd sorted out the chaos enough to try one of the 8th Hussar, 1st Hussars of Canada tanks across, getting across this. And he came across very, very slowly, but he made it. I went back and got hold of the infantry battalion commander and said, come on, you can start going forward now because one of your tanks is over. And so he started to do that. And a long procession of Canadian infantry started to go over. And then we got another tank over. Then the third tank, Canadian tank, had a go at it. And you could see the driver was looking out at the front, and you could see that he wasn't really sure of himself. And he got a track off the bridge and fell off on his side. But this was, I thought this sort of thing might happen, and this is why we had got an Avery over first, because the Avery had a very powerful winch on it, and we got a rope to this Canadian tank, which was a Sherman tank, lighter than the Avery, and towed him over onto the far side. And then, in the meantime, we were repairing the mess that this driver had made. And then the tanks, and all the time it was being made better by rubble and stuff. By then, some of the beach group had landed. In particular, there was a field company, I think it was 84 field company, who were engineers and would take over our gaps when we left. And so we made use of them, and they had a very good young subaltern in charge of one of their troops, who obviously was responsible for this gap, and he came forward, and he'd been lightly wounded, but he didn't let this worry him. I wish I could remember his name, because I got him an MC. He did very well that day, and all his men came forward, and so we were working hard to improve this gap the whole time, and it got better and better until it was comparatively easy to drive a tank over. And then we even started to get a few wheeled vehicles over, and still we improved it. And that really, in outline, is what happened on that particular beach.
What do you mean by beach group?
Sorry. The beach group was an organization, I think commanded by a brigadier, it had an infantry battalion, which wasn't Canadian, it was an English, British infantry battalion, and it had engineer units. It had an engineer battalion with it. And I think probably that engineer battalion had engineer regiment had four field companies, of which I think 84 field company was the one that was landing opposite Grez-sur-Mer.
How do flail tanks operate?
They are normal Sherman tanks with a normal Sherman gun, and on the front of the tank there is a big sort of axle, and from that axle depend a number, probably 40, heavy chains with a metal steel blob on the end of each chain. And the idea is that this is engaged by the engine, and this axle rotates, and the flails then start rotating and thump the ground in front of the tracks of the tank. As I say, the idea being that as the flail comes down, it will hit any mine, blow it up, so that the tank then can continue to go forward. I think we already knew that the Germans had developed a fuse to nullify this, which isn't all that difficult to do. You can have a fuse that won't go off at the first knock, but will go off at the second knock. And, of course, the second knock would be the track of the tank going over, and not all the mines, telemines, German anti-tank mines, had these fuses, but some did, enough to knock out all our flail tanks.
How did you know the crater size so accurately?
This was measured afterwards. I didn't at the time. I could just see it was a damn big crater. I didn't at the time know it was 66 feet.
You mentioned the willingness of the farmer to give you the cast and horse.
Yes.
Did the Normans generally welcome the invasion?
Yes. Yes, they certainly did. Afterwards, we met odd farmers and so on who were only too delighted to give us eggs and to improve the box rations that we were subsisting on, and chickens and things, which our people could buy from them for very little money. Yes, they were very helpful. I think they realized that at last. They probably expected this was going to happen sooner or later. They didn't expect it was going to happen there, but they were very friendly, and they still are. And, of course, only recently, earlier this year, was the 40th anniversary, and I went over and stayed with the mayor, Grez-sur-Mer. He wouldn't, and so did a lot of other members of both my squadron and 84 Company, and he wouldn't let us pay for a thing over there. Let me his car, put us all up, gave us all our meals and so on.
Did you come across any pro-German Normans?
No, not one.
What happened on the second day?
Well, just to complete the first day, when this very sort of improvised crossing was going fairly smoothly, I left it to Jimi Hendry, and I knew that I couldn't get my tank across the Searle River, but I wanted to know what the other half squadron were doing. So I set off to walk across there. I walked into by myself, which is probably rather silly. I walked into the middle of Searle, of course Searle, and found that the river was spanned by a swing bridge, and the bridge was swung so that you couldn't cross it, so that it was open. And I could see also, the first thing I looked for, being an engineer, was it prepared for demolition? And I could see it was. And as I got near this bridge, I wasn't just sort of walking down the road, I was rather nipping from doorway to doorway, because there was a bit of shooting going on. I met a Frenchman, and I asked him in my best French about this bridge, and he said, "Be careful, there are snipers," and he pointed to a building a bit further upstream in the sort of little harbour that Courcelles contains. Sort of in the, it's in the middle of the village itself. And at that moment, a Canadian soldier just appeared, all by himself. So I said, I pointed to him where the sniper was coming from, as explained by the Frenchman, and I asked him if he could make sure he kept that man's head down, which he proceeded to do very effectively. I don't know whether he in fact shot him or what, but I heard him firing every so often. And then I went to have a look at these charges on the bridge, and I could, I think the bridge was, so to speak, on my side of the river, and it could be swung across, and there was a great wheel to swing it by hand. Anyway, I ripped the charges off and threw them into the... they were underneath the bridge, and threw them into the river. And then the Frenchman came to me, and I said, "Well, what do we do? Do we turn that wheel?" And he said, "Oh, yes, I'll show you how." And we, the two of us, got hold of this wheel, and we ground the thing round. And very slowly the bridge moved till it was spanning the river. We had by then no opposition from the enemy. If there were snipers there, they weren't operating. And I nipped across it and then went down back towards the beach on the far side, on the Courcelles side, on the east side of the river. On my way down there, I met Dickie Bowes coming on, so to speak, the same mission, i.e. to come and contact me. Everything he'd done, everything that was expected of him, he'd launched his bridges against the wall. His problem was quite different there. There was a wall, and which, of course, is a complete tank obstacle. And I just saw on page 205 of this book you have on the table here.
This is Chute's book on D-Day, yes?
That the situation at Bernier, which was the next beach down from us, and a different squadron was landing there, was very similar to the situation at Courcelles, and one of these assault bridges of ours has been launched by the squadron at Bernier. Now, this is what Dickie Bowes had done, and the other troop commander, whose name was Ray Mayer, they had both launched their bridges and got up, got up themselves, and then enabled other tanks to get up and go inland through Courcelles. So they had done exactly what was asked of them, which was excellent. We then decided to get the squadron together, and I think I chose from the map an area towards the south of the village of Courcelles, which looked as though it would give us a bit of cover and where we could sort ourselves out for the night. So I went back and told the two troop commanders. By then, Jimmy Hewitt had made, I think, another gap where he was meant to have landed in the first place, although it was never very successful, that gap. It was heavily mined, and they spent a long time clearing the mines. There were no other obstacles there, but he spent a long time doing that. Then I told the troop commanders to collect their tanks, cross over onto the main east-west coast road, get off the beaches, in fact, and then follow me through the town. We crossed this bridge that I had swung open. I think we were too heavy a load for that bridge, really. And at the end, where the last tank had come over, it looked a bit bent. And it had to be replaced by a Bailey Bridge later on. And we made for this place I'd selected, which turned out to be quite reasonable. And we put ourselves into a sort of defensive perimeter there in case of any trouble. And I think each tank brewed up a meal, and we then slept there, just either under the tanks in case of being shelled, or in the tanks. So that was the end of the first day. Incidentally, I think it was only once that German aircraft had come over during the whole of D-Day, and then four, I think they were Fokker Wolf fighters, came over. They didn't trouble us. They dropped a few bombs, I think harmlessly, into the sea, and they were travelling pretty fast, and everything shot at them. So they didn't linger. And that was the only aerial opposition we had. Otherwise, the skies were full of our aircraft, which was good to see.
Was this on the second day?
No, all that's on the first day. The second... Oh, on the evening of the first day, by arrangement, I had to go and report to the brigade commander of the Canadian Brigade. His name was Brigadier Forster, F-O-R-S-T-E-R, and it was the 7th Canadian Brigade. I had brought on one of the tanks a motorcycle in order to do this, because I knew I was going to have to do it. So I set off to find the brigade headquarters, which was marked up. There were little... the brigade headquarters has a certain sign, and there were these signs were showed where to go. I went off, driving carefully on the right of the road, and as I went round one corner, there in front of me was a Frenchman waving a bottle. And I stopped. I realized what he was doing, and this turned out to be a bottle of Calvados, which is powerful stuff. But anyway, I just stopped, took time of day with him. Had a good slug of this stuff, and feeling a lot better, I got back onto my motorcycle, started off, and stupidly, I started off on the left side of the road, which is the way, of course, we drive normally in England, and round the corner, going a bit too fast, came a Canadian on a motorcyclist, and he hit me, and I went over his head into a ditch. I was unhurt, and so was he, but his motorcycle wasn't too bad. Mine was absolute write off. Luckily, it turned out that the brigade headquarters was in the field on the edge of this ditch that I'd fallen into. So I reported to the Canadian brigadier. By then, I didn't really have much to say. I mean, he had passed over the beaches, over our bridges. He knew what had gone on there, more or less. And he just thanked us and asked me to move forward a bit on the next day, D plus one, in case we would be required further forward. I may say that I was having trouble with my ears by then. I couldn't hear much. However, next day, early in the morning, I think dawn, we stood to in a normal way, and I remember some British aircraft came over, and a unit next door to us opened fire on them. They were obviously Spitfires, and I ran over. I remember screaming annoyance at them, telling them to stop it. So we weren't all that well-trained, all of us. And then